What I'd like to do is just go around the room and hear everybody's name, because I don't know everybody. Haven't met everyone. And I think it's also just nice in the space to hear everybody.
Sunil.
David.
Mike.
Heather.
Stephen.
Lauren.
Kalinda.
Patty.
Dasha.
Connie.
Heather.
Sarah.
Claire.
Lisa.
Laura.
Mandy.
Michael.
Pamela.
Suchi.
Nikki.
Day.
Thank you. Yay. Okay, and we have some quick announcements. First of all, I want to see who's here. Jeremy's not here. Lauren's here. And Heather's here.
And Belinda's here.
Okay, so I just wanted to introduce the board. So if you guys could stand up. It's really great. They are overseeing our direction, and it sounds like they are a working board, meaning they get together once a month and figure out what needs to be done and who's volunteering for what, because we're a completely volunteer organization. And they have a lot of fun together, and they also think of things in ways that we can have fun together. If you have any suggestions about what you'd like to see here, any feedback, any complaints.
Any compliments?
These are people to speak to. Okay. And as I mentioned, we're completely volunteer, and we don't have like a big pool of, what do I want to say? We don't do the whole membership thing. We just have whoever comes. You are Diamond Light, right? For as long as you're here. So we have an extended community that's very flowy. So sometimes we'll have 50 people here, and sometimes we'll have 10 people here, and different people come for different things. So if you're ever interested in volunteering and getting more involved and helping bring snacks or food or set up or put on an event or anything like that, just speak to one of the board members. And there's a lot of fun things coming up over the summer. I just wanted to say what is coming up right away. On Monday, Sunil's going to start Compassionate Communication, a four-week, really experiential NVC, Nonviolent Communication-based class. And I personally am super excited about this. So do you want to say anything about it?
So it's really about some, along the lines of how do we cultivate compassion in our lives, but through using ordinary speech, and how do we train our attention so we change our habits.
And part of why I really wanted him to do this, and hope he will continue to share this and build the skill with us, because it's a huge tool, and one of the Eightfold Path is right speech. And like, where do we learn that, right? How do we really figure out how to do that in conflict, in the midst of our lives? How do we create peaceful speech and so on? How do we get in touch with our own? How do we speak kindly to ourselves? All of that. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
And then on Saturday and Sunday, June 3rd and 4th, Dr. Winston McCullough is coming to lead a weekend workshop on karma emptiness and positive psychology. So he is a long-term Tibetan practitioner. This is going to be one of those big events, because he hasn't come for a year, and he usually comes at least once a year. And he teaches at Oregon State University. And he's also founded the Center for Contemplative Sciences up there. So he really has his finger on the pulse of Tibetan Buddhism and also positive psychology and how it's starting to come together with this idea of science, what's scientific, and what's happening in our spiritual lives and how we talk about it between science and Buddhism. And then we have Serving the Homeless Breakfast coming up May 19th. I hope I have the date right. Dasha, there you are.
Probably.
Okay. Pardon?
The third Friday of the month.
Third Friday of the month. So if you're interested, this again, I think it's getting, is it getting so popular you're turning people away?
Well, we don't turn anybody away, because okay. We always need food and supplies and help. And we also have a Sunday weekly program, so if Friday's are full, you can always participate on Sunday. But we do only need 9 volunteers for each breakfast, so we can only...
So sign up early.
Sign up early, yes. That's the answer for everything.
You know, the Dalai Lama himself has for a long time said Christians really have the corner on the market of serving others in a hands-on way. And he's been encouraging us Buddhists to step it up. And so this is, I've been so excited that Dasha has taken the lead on starting this program with serving the homeless breakfasts on Sundays and then on the third Friday. And not only that, it's really true. When we give to others, we feel better. Like every time I do this, I walk away thinking, you know, I just gave you food, but you gave me something that's like glowing inside my heart for the whole rest of the day. So I highly recommend participating in whatever way you can. And then David is going to begin community meditation on Thursdays at 6:30 here. So it'll be 6:30 to 8.
Yeah.
Yeah.
See what it grows into, yeah.
Yeah, and so he's developing a great program. So what the idea is that you can drop in anytime, whenever you have a Thursday free to join in. And at the same time, there will be some progression and some growth within it. So hats off to you for figuring that one out. And so come check it out, and everyone's invited, no matter how much experience or how little experience you have meditating. And, you know, my experience is getting my butt on the cushion is a lot easier if there are other people in the room with me and if I've made that commitment with other people. So, and it's more fun. And then I didn't know if the Karma course is still, like, my computer internet crashed, so I couldn't look
yes,
it up.
Yes, we have 4 more weeks.
4 more weeks of studying karma in depth here. Is that okay if people jump in the middle? Or
mm-hmm.
So Heather's teaching that. And if you have any interest in what karma means, how it works, and why it might be important in your life, feel free to come on Wednesday starting tomorrow and check it out, because it's really one of the most in-depth, detailed courses on karma and emptiness that I've ever experienced in my long life as a Buddhist. All right. Now I'm going to go back to where I left off.
We also have a mailing list, so you could sign up at the back if you're not on it yet.
Okay, so I wanted to talk about, like, what we're talking about here in Western terms is often, and Winston may talk about this, I don't know, is the difference between, have you heard about hedonic pleasure or hedonic happiness and genuine happiness? So the idea of hedonic happiness is it's all about what do I get? I want more. And there's nothing wrong with wanting a good meal with your sweetheart or wanting to hang out with your family or go see a movie or get a working car. The thing is that we think it's going to make us happy, and we think that happiness is going to last. And we think that happiness is out there, right? And my husband and I like to joke. They say money can't buy happiness or a good, but we sure would like to find out if that was true or not. And on the Tibet, on our Facebook page, there's just somebody's posted something that was an interview by this guy who wrote and I think starred in a movie called Ace Ventura, right?
He made quite a few films, actually.
He made quite a few films. And then he gave it all, and then he realized, you know, he had reached the pinnacle.
Oh, I've heard of this. One of the actors in the movie.
In the movie.
Not Jim Carrey.
It was
the director. Okay. I think there's an inside joke here. Not that I haven't yet. Never seen the movie. So. But basically what he talks about is he ends up giving it all up, gives up his literally, I think it's like 20,000 square foot mansion in Hollywood. And now he lives in a trailer park. And he talks about now he has happiness. And why and how that is. So it's that idea that as long as we think happiness is out there, who's in control of our happiness? Is it us?
Whoever's selling the thing out there.
Pardon?
Whoever's selling the thing out there.
Whoever's selling the thing out there. That's right. Right. Yeah. Like, and that's it. As long as we think it's out there and someone else is controlling it and we can't control whether we get it or not or how long it lasts, then we don't have a peaceful heart. We don't have genuine happiness. We don't have ease of well-being. Right? We have dissatisfaction, disappointment, and disempowerment, really, because our hearts and minds are in the control of someone else. So in the Buddhist world, this hedonic pleasure is often called, sometimes called, the eight worldly winds. And what they are is they come in pairs, in four pairs, each revolving around a kind of object. So one is gain and loss, which is kind of like a hope for pleasure and being delighted and feeling delighted when we experience sense pleasure. It's like fantastic sights and...
I think the first one is pain and pleasure.
Pain and gain.
Yeah, hope for pleasure, fear of pain.
Fear of pain. Hope for gain and loss.
The fourth one is also gain and loss.
Oh, I messed it. Oh, I'm sorry, yeah. Okay, pleasure and pain. Sorry. Mm-hmm. So it's that sensual delight in sounds and movies and going out to dinner and the new red car that's in your driveway and all of that. And so we're delighted when that happens, but then we get disappointed, dejected, upset when we have unpleasant experiences, especially unpleasant physical sensate experiences or mental. And then taking delight, the gain and loss, let's see, now get this right, matched up with my list there, is like we take delight when we get things, when we have money and possessions, and the other part of the pair is if we lose them, right? And then feeling delighted with good reputation, bad reputation, like we hope, they say hope for fame, but I just think it's just you want people in your world to talk good about you, right? Like, just think about your work world. How do you feel if you hear that someone's praised you? Like, Claire, you did such a great job yesterday and that, such and such. And then you hear somebody else talking about how well you did. You just feel kind of good and elevated. And then when you hear even a whisper of something bad about you, even if it's not true, it can send us into a tailspin. And then, did I hit them all? Praise and blame. You know, we love being praised. And we don't like being blamed for anything. I mean, how defensive can we get? How quickly, if someone even hints that we might be responsible for something negative? Yeah. So these eight worldly concerns keep us pretty busy in our life. Most of our life spent trying to get the pair of the four that we want and keep the others at bay. So I thought I'd tell you this Zen story that is pretty cool about this. And it's a student, and this is supposedly, this is historically accurate, where a student and a Zen master lived across the river from each other in China, and they would often get together and discuss their practice and discuss Buddhism. And one day, the student, whose name was Su Dongpo, felt inspired and wrote the following poem. I bow my head to the heaven within heaven, hairline rays illuminating the universe. The eight winds cannot move me, sitting still upon the purple lotus. Does anybody have a clue what he just said? So basically what he's saying is he's attained such a deep peace in his spiritual life that these eight things never, the eight worldly winds don't even affect him anymore. He's kind of gone beyond that. And so he's so impressed with himself for having reached this state, which is always a red flag, that he sends a servant out to carry that poem to his teacher, Foyin. And when Foyin reads the poem, he immediately sees what it is. And smiling, he writes this big word, fart, over it. And has it returned to Su Dongpo. So Su Dongpo there is sitting there. He thinks he's pretty cool, right? He thinks he's just reached this high level of attainment, and he's expecting his teacher to send big flowery compliments, seal of approval. He gets this back, and it's his own paper, his own poem, with the word fart written across it. And he gets really, really, really upset. kind of like, how dare he insult me like this, that lousy old monk. He's got a lot of explaining to do. So indignant, he rushes out of the house and gets the boat to ferry him to the other side of the river so he can set this guy straight, right? And he gets there, and Foyen's door is closed, and the house is empty, or the hut is empty, and on the door is a piece of paper with Su Dongpo's name on it. And he opens it up and reads it and says, "The eight worldly winds cannot move me. One fart blows me across the river." Yeah. So the point, I think this was a turning point in Su Dongpo's spiritual development. So the eight worldly winds is actually a big theme in Buddhist teachings, in Tibetan Buddhist teachings. And Lama Yeshe, who's one of the FPMT founders, used to talk a lot about how we have what's he called yo-yo ma. Yo-yo ma. Yo-yo mind. I wouldn't mind having yo-yo ma. But it's just that thing, you know, I get a present, I feel so happy. I lost that wonderful gift, I feel so unhappy and dejected. Somebody says you're wonderful, and we feel up. And then somebody says you made a mistake in your accounting, and you feel down. And this constant yo-yo mind is just so dependent on external objects and people, and it just leaves us totally oblivious to where the source of true peace, true happiness, true well-being resides, which is our minds, our own hearts and minds, right? Because we've bought into the appearances of this life. We really think that money and material things and praise and approval and a good reputation and marvelous sense experiences are going to make us happy. And that's what the Buddha calls our ignorance, our confusion. We confuse things that aren't lasting and aren't going to bring us real, genuine well-being with things that do. And I mean, that gets so reinforced now. It's like Mandy said, right? We want what they tell us to want. This is a consumer culture. And then we start to believe it. And then we end up disappointed and frustrated because we thought those things were going to make us happy. So what our yearning and our feeling of there being something greater points to is genuine happiness, which is all about the quality of our own hearts and mind that we bring into the world rather than we get from the world. And that's huge, because then where does the locus of control, the power, the ability to create that reside? Right? If it's our own hearts and minds, then who's it up to? And it's pretty radical, actually. Because what they say is, like, happiness is always an inside job. And I'm not saying that there aren't miserable circumstances in this world. You know, there are really what I consider living hell realms on this earth. And right now my heart is breaking, just breaking for all the suffering that we read about in this world. And that's okay. I mean, that's having an open, soft, tender heart and connected and understanding that we're all interdependent. And that when that happens to them, that's happening to me on a certain level. It's happening to each one of us. What I also know and hear about is that even within the worst of the worst circumstances, people find altruistic happiness, a sense of purpose and joy and meaning, which is wild. I mean, like, it's how can that be? And yet it happens. And that just shows to me on a certain level, again, that it really isn't dependent on outside circumstances. Someone, like I mentioned, I just spent a few weeks in another community, and I was talking to a woman who is from Holland, and she spent several months in the last year in the refugee camps in Europe. And we spent a lot of time talking about her experience, And it was so moving. And she said a couple things. And one, she said, I've never felt more intimate with anybody in my entire life than I did sitting with those refugees when I, you know, was with them. And she would stay in each place for a month, 6 weeks, 2 months, 3 months. So she was really with them. It wasn't just let me pop in and give you food, which is great, but she was with them, often without any language shared. She also said what just astonished her was in these incredible, what she said was to her mind, they were just a step away from concentration camps. Literally, she said that was her feeling there. People, they're called, you know, refugee camps, but people aren't free to come and go. Mm-hmm. You know, they're imprisoned, basically. She said within there, just the moments of joy and the way people were taking care of each other. And even just in the midst of not knowing what's going to happen tomorrow to you, what happened to your family, was just astonishing. And she said the levels of happiness she often saw were just more than she would see on the street at home. Right? And again, it's not everybody, but it just shows me. It's just, again, we were talking about how it just proves that happiness, that well-being, that a sense of purpose and meaning and connection and remembering what's most important in this life doesn't really depend on our outside circumstances. And yet, where do we put most of our energy? Right? I still put way too much energy trying to like line up everything out there to make my life feel good and meaningful and happy. Like, I'll be happy once this lines up. And yeah, I want to do a retreat, and to do that, I have to have this condition, and like, I could spend 5 years designing and building the ideal retreat hut, and then I'll die before I get there. rather than just finding the source of connection, interconnection, well-being, and genuine happiness that I bring. And empowering, you know, Rumi said, yesterday I was lover, at least this is attributed to Rumi, I feel like I have to fact check everything and I didn't fact check this, so caveat. Yesterday I was clever, so I wanted to change the world. Today I am wise, so I am changing myself. And this is empowering, because Master Shantideva says, well, if the world has thorns, how are you going to cover the world with leather? You put sandals on your own feet, right? Because the same thing, you can't control what's going on out there. And one of my heroes in this world, Viktor Frankl, who was a Holocaust survivor and one of those people who found genuine happiness and meaning and spiritual fulfillment right in the midst of a concentration camp, said, life is never made unbearable by circumstances, but only by a lack of meaning and purpose. I think that's another modern way of talking about it. You know, when we feel a spiritual connection, we feel something part of something bigger, connecting, belonging, meaning, that's where we find our happiness. So that's how we get to cultivate genuine happiness in our busy, crazy, hectic daily lives. That's the point here. That everything we look at, that if we could just change this on the outside, don't believe it. You know, don't believe in that, really. Believe in this sense that when we can work with our own minds and hearts, that as we, as Elaine likes to say, as we start to get swept away down the river of misery, right, that we just bring ourselves back to the practices that we know and learn and the worldview that we know and learn. And even just looking around, like I've been practicing this with the beautiful green trees and the foliage and this happy spring earth. Like if I notice my own mind is getting really disturbed and upset about something, it's like, we interrupt this programming to bring you a commercial break. Look at the trees. And you just feel like this sense of peace and a sense of empowerment. You know, you're no longer spinning out of control. So Buddhism is pragmatic. We can get into philosophical discussions, but really, Tibetan Buddhist comes down to, let's look at what works to open up that wellspring of joy and connection and meaning and well-being. Right? If it doesn't work, you can, you know, enjoy your philosophical ruminating and debating. But what we really want to know is what works. Okay? And there are two things that we really work with in Tibetan Buddhism. I'm thinking you can break it up in so many different ways. One is wisdom and compassion. So developing our worldview, how it is that we think and begin to see the world accurately. And then the other is the open, loving heart, which is actually just seeing the way things are, which is we are all deeply interconnected. Claire and I were talking a little bit about Thich Nhat Hanh. One of his most beautiful teachings is he talks about interbeing and interdependence, that, and it's so true, you pick up any object and start to look at it deeply, and the whole world is in that object. Like, we pick this up and think about everything that came into this little tangerine. And we could spend hours literally thinking about it. And some of the biggest ones, you did, what are the first ones you think of?
The sun.
The sun.
Rain.
What's that?
Rain.
Rain.
Soil.
Dirt.
Soil, dirt.
The one that picked it.
The one that picked it.
The one who planted it.
The one who planted it.
The
one who got the seed, collected the seeds, planted.
Earthworms, nitrogen.
And then, exactly. Okay, so then we take one of those people. Like, what about the one who planted it?
His parents.
His parents.
The parents of his parents.
The parents of his parents. Right? And all the food that they needed to survive.
What he was thinking when he planted it.
And what he was thinking when he planted it? Yeah.
Yeah, what he was thinking.
What he was thinking when he planted it.
And all the tools he
used. Yeah, and his vision, right? Like, I'm going to plant, even think about it, I'm going to plant this, and in 20 years, it'll be giving fruit to the world. You know? And then I start thinking, okay, about them harvesting it. And who made the tools that they used to harvest it? And then who got the wood for the things that they used to harvest it with? And the steel, and then all the people that built the factory that made that thing. I mean, see what I mean? And then if you could really trace it out, you would find out it wasn't just even contained within the United States, right? We'd probably map it out, and it would start to encompass the whole world and everything in the world. So like it or not, you are never alone. And like it or not, you are never existing in isolation. And every time we think we are, we're confused. So that is one aspect of worldview. And out of that flows compassion. Because if we're all interconnected, pain isn't my pain. Suffering isn't my suffering. I shouldn't then work just to eradicate, to stop my pain. Then I've got to start working and caring about stopping everyone's pain. Just stopping the amount of pain there is in the world. So what wisdom and compassion actually mean, those are considered the two wings of enlightenment, and they talk about the big Garuda bird that they're trying to fly. You can't fly with just one wing, you need both wings. So if you want awakening, we have to develop both wisdom, worldview, and compassion, or method and wisdom. Or here I broke it down into worldview and practice. Like, what are we going to put into practice in our daily lives? So we're going to learn about these things like the eight worldly winds. Now how are we going to watch that play out in our lives and start to take the power back and not be blown across the river by a fart? So practice is really, how do we work with our own hearts and our own minds in the midst of our daily life? And we'll do both in each class. So any questions on that before we shift to 20 minutes of meditation and a little talking about meditation, or thoughts or anything to... Wow, all crystal clear? That's really amazing.
Good teacher.
Wow, look at me. Hey, that's praise. Good call. All right, so when we go into practice, one of the basic practices of all Buddhism, and especially Tibetan Buddhism, is meditation. Okay. And I don't even remember if I put it on here. I think I may have run out. Okay. Well, we can put that up. How's that? Meditation. Now we all know where we are. So the very foundation of all meditation is actually training our attention. How's your attention, focused attention these days? Why do I hear laughter?
What is that?
Now I'm laughing. What is that? Yeah. So we live in, I've noticed when I'm on the internet, it wasn't always like this, but now it goes something like this. Oh, wow, compassion. I wonder what the Buddhist definition of compassion is. Oh, look at that. There's a link to Sufism. I forgot about Sufism. Let me look at that. Oh, wow, Dances of Universal Peace. I wonder if there are any in Sacramento. And about 5 minutes later, I totally have forgotten exactly why I was on the internet at all. You know, it's like this mind, as fast as the mind can move now, that's where attention can get reinforced by interacting with the outside world. Very different from trying to develop what's called shamatha, meaning sustained attention. It's often translated as calm abiding meditation or quiescence meditation. Basically, it just means being able to choose a meditation object, place your mind on there, and stay there. And there are 9 levels, which we won't have time to study, but when you get to a trend, the first level is just even remembering that you're meditating, literally. It's like, I'm sitting down to watch my breath, and 2 seconds later, you're off in la-la land, and about 20 minutes later, you realize you're sitting on a cushion and you were actually meant to be watching your breath. And that's actually what mindfulness is in this context. It literally means, shmirti, it literally means to remember the fact that you have a meditation object and your intention is to meditate on it, and then to keep bringing yourself back to it. So for hundreds and hundreds of generations, this has been developed to a very high degree among Buddhist meditators, and it's considered the fundamental skill underpinning all meditation practices. Because how are you going to do complex visualizations if you can't sustain your meditation practice? And it's actually a progression of practices, and as I mentioned, when you start, you may sit down. Well, let me ask a question. How many of you in this room have meditated before? Or how many are kind of have a daily meditation practice? How many would like more meditation instruction or meditation instruction at all? Okay. So the nice thing about developing meditation is it doesn't actually have to belong to Buddhist or non-Buddhist. It belongs to all of us. It's, again, something that we can all develop. It doesn't adhere to any religious creed or belief system. And basically, it's just developing what someone said, that they wanted balance in their lives, and that can mean so many things. It can mean between work and play and rest and stress and, or, you know, like that. This is developing mental, and actually leads to emotional balance. It's just developing intentional balance. So usually we're multitasking. We're oscillating between excitement and exhaustion, right? We're kind of hyper alert or we're exhausted and dull. And another way to think about it is we're often oscillating between restlessness and boredom. And Tsongkhapa, the Jade Tsongkhapa, who is the founder of our particular lineage, said that until you develop shamatha, single-pointed focus on a meditation object, the mind has you. You don't have a mind. Right? The mind has you. You don't have a mind. What does that mean? How many of you have been driven crazy by your own thoughts, ruminating and going, like especially maybe 2:30 or 3 in the morning when you wake up, there's something about that time, and you're like, shut up, just quit thinking, give me some rest. That's what is meant by the mind has you, right? And Alan Wallace, one of my teachers and close teachers these days, has talked about it as being an obsessive compulsive delusional disorder. Obsessive because the thoughts are obsessive, right? And they're compulsive, and they're delusional because we believe them. Like there's a narrator going, and we actually believe what they're telling us. It's like a talk radio show that you can't turn off. Or my personal thing now, going into a restaurant, I'm old-fashioned. I actually like quiet and being able to talk to people. And when there are these loud TVs that you can't turn off, it's like, oh yeah, that's like the obsessive delusional compulsive mind right there. So the thing is, though, that you could add it in. It's not just that. It's like it jumps from channel to channel to channel to channel. Like a couple years ago, we were teaching in Bulgaria, and we went into the restaurant there, and they had this channel on that was like an MTV. And I think Mark started timing it, and each image lasted, what was it, like 1.5 seconds or 2 seconds or something?
Half a second.
Half a second? And it's like that quick, right? There's no stability. It's just like that's how fast things are moving and jumping. So that is like welcome to your mind, right? Constantly ruminating about the past, fantasizing about the future, or it's called the default wandering mind, just narrating what's happening and what you want to be have happening. And one of the ways I noticed it is, oh, this is how I would tell the story to someone else about what's happening in my life right now. So instead of experiencing it, I'm like making up this whole story as if I'm going to tell it to somebody else, which I never do, but it's like it's going on. Does anyone else do that, or am I the only one? So that's the obsessive part, you know, that we're obsessively drawn to ruminating and the fantasies. And then the compulsive is just that it sucks us in. And the delusional is that we believe it. So it's really interesting because you can think about, without that narrator story that we're listening to, sucked into and believing, would I even exist? How would I experience myself if that wasn't there? It's just an interesting question to throw out and think about. It's very interesting talking about one little tidbit about whoever was interested in science and crossover. The Buddha taught that part of our genuine happiness comes from balancing the mind, stilling the mind, and finding deeper peace, a baseline peacefulness of our heart and mind, and that that meant stopping that default wandering mind and being able to rest in spaciousness. So scientists, God knows, I don't know how they measured this, but last year they came out saying that people who have less ruminating, less default wandering mind, less narration going on, are happier. So once again, just proved what the Buddha taught 2600. So I think that we all kind of, I sense, relate to this. So I could go on and on and on about this because it's one of my favorite subjects. It's like, what is it that's happening in our mind? And how is it happening? And why is it that when we first start to meditate,
we often feel like, meditation is driving me nuts. I'm crazy. My mind's out of control when I because I'm meditating. It's not that our mind is out of control because we're meditating. It's that we slow down and try and quiet down, and we begin to see how out of control our minds are. Okay? So that happens to everyone. Don't be too hard on yourself. So let's do the very first shamatha fundamental stabilization practice of meditation. And I say fundamental as in you could call this beginners, but you could also call it what you come back to as long as you meditate your whole career. And I just did a 3-week practice period and spent hours just doing this. It's very profound. So the first thing is you want to find a posture where you feel very stable. You're welcome to sit on a cushion, on the chair. You're even welcome to do Shavasana if that's more comfortable for you. You want to have your hands like resting on your knees and your lap, just so that your shoulders can be in line with your hips, your ears in line with your shoulders, so there's a sense of your spine being straight. And I really like that feeling of that you're through your sit bones, you're grounding down right into the Mother Earth. And then with especially with your inhalation and your spine, you're reaching up into the heavens. And that fills you with both energies of being grounded down and lifting up. And now begin by just releasing any fantasies of the future, any memories of the past. It's like you decide to give yourself a little mental vacation, mental emotional vacation. And we do this by shifting our awareness away from that narrative and away from the surroundings, and begin to allow your attention, your awareness, to engage the present moment of your physical sensations of the body. And throughout the meditation session, it helps to keep as physically still as you can, as the stillness of the body helps the stillness of the mind. You know, bring your awareness so you feel the solidity of your body wherever it contacts the floor, your seat, the chair. Exploring and engaging the simple sensations of firmness and solidity where your body and the chair or the floor are in contact. And as soon, not if, but when, as soon as you notice that your attention has gone off hand in hand with a thought, a rumination, a fantasy, let go of the hand of that thought. Bring your full awareness back to the felt physical tactile sensation. Now bringing that awareness down to the soles of your feet. Exploring whatever sensations arise there. Temperatures, pressures, tingling. Begin to allow your own pace, your awareness, to slowly rise up to your head, towards your head from the soles of your feet. Exploring sensations both on the surface and inside. Maybe especially noticing any sensations of tension, pain, contraction, movement, spaciousness, temperature. Again, anytime you notice that you've gone off hand in hand with a thought down the path of rumination, allow yourself to release the grasp from that hand, bringing your full attention back to the felt tactile sensations. Being happy about it, because success in meditation is returning again and again. Seeing if you can bring your awareness and attention into the tactile sensations with no concept, no labeling, no extra, just going into a direct felt experience. You can begin to add in that wherever you experience or encounter tension as you scan through your body, invite your inhalation right into the center of that experience of tension or pain, and allow it to self-release on the exhalation. Releasing any tension or pain as in the out-breath. Seeing what are the most subtle sensations you can be aware of and experience in your body. And what are the biggest? beginning to release the object of meditation, allowing your attention and your awareness to expand first through your whole body, and then re-engaging with the room and environment around you. And once you're ready, opening your eyes. So that's the first step of settling the body, because meditation is actually an embodied practice. It actually happens in our body. And it also, we began to start the first balance of relaxing deeply and releasing tension without falling asleep, which is often the big challenge. So I'll invite you again to just take a few minutes of your day, see what it's like. There are two things. One is you could start your day or end your day or both just with 3 minutes, 5 minutes, set a timer. It's nice to set a little timer because then you're not looking at or your watch every 30 seconds. When you first start meditating especially, and then it comes around again, 30 seconds can feel like 30 years. And then the flip side is you just let go of control because you're not trying to think about the time. Something else out there is going to tell you when it's time to end. So try that in the morning, in the evening. And then there's kind of this secret, especially if you happen to be at a cubicle at a desk. People don't know you're meditating if you're just sitting there quietly. So you could even sneak in a little meditation, especially if the day's getting a little rugged. See what happens. So just want to invite you to try that once a day. Look for those opportunities. All right, it's 8:30, so thank you so much. I was going to ask for questions, but we ran out of time. So bring them next week.
You got to come next week with your
questions. You got to come next week with your questions. And we'll do closing prayers, and then we'll do three prostrations again.
Sashi Rupi Jushin Meto Jam Rira Rishi Nende Yampadi Sangye Shingdu Nite Uwagi Drokun Amga Shingla Shupasho Iram Guru Ratnam Andalakam Niryatayami Gewadi Gewokum Sunam Yeshe Soksokshin Sunam Yeshe Lechumwe Dampa Kuni Topasho.
Next week, put your practice into practice.